This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It's not hard to make the case that Ted Williams, who played his entire career with the Boston Red Sox, was baseball's greatest hitter ever. He hit for average, the last player to hit 400 in a season, and he hit with power.
Over 17 seasons, he won 6 batting titles, 4 home run titles, and 4 RBI titles. And he hit well consistently, starting in his rookie year in 1939 until his final at-bat in 1960.
Like to hit one out of here right now.
There's a drive to deep right center. This may be gone. Bradley back there watching. Hold on, Ted Williams.
Williams defined grace and accomplishment on the baseball diamond, but off the field he was a roiling mix of contradictions. Proud but angry, generous but combative, adored by fans but at war with members of the press, revered by his son but often unkind to those closest to him.
Ben Bradley Jr., a reporter and editor of the Boston Globe for 25 years, spent a decade tracking down Williams' friends and relatives to write a new and deeply personal account of Teddy Ballgame's life. It's called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, and Ben Bradley Jr. is with us now. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to meet you and great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's really good to have you. What a work you did, a decade putting this book together. And I want to invite listeners into this conversation. Listeners, what are your memories of Ted Williams, if you're old enough to remember him? Did you ever see him play? Do you think he is the greatest hitter of all times? What questions do you have for Ben Bradley Jr., who spent a good chunk of time researching a lot about this extraordinary ballplayer's life? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Ben, I'd love to just start asking you a little bit about Williams as the hitter, obviously, known for his talent with the bat. He was tall. He was skinny. He didn't look like a David Ortiz type. How did he generate such power?
Well, you know, a lot of it was bat speed, and he pioneered the use of a lighter bat back in the day when he first went to the Louisville Slugger factory and asked for a lighter bat. They looked at him like he was crazy because the convention of the day was for the big sluggers to use big, heavy bats. But Williams's theory was that if you had a lighter bat, you could get more bat speed and increase the whip and the torque, sort of like what pro golfers do, the speed of the swing. And that was a new novel theory. But there were other elements to his hitting. He had great natural gifts of eyesight and timing and coordination, and he believed in a slightly uppercut swing from low to high to get the ball up in the air for better power.
He was a real student of the game. We've got some cuts of Ted Williams to listen to. Here he is talking about his sort of the way he was a student of hitting. He was talking with Bob Costas back in 1993 about modern-day baseball players, but I think what he's saying about them offers some insight into just how obsessed with the science of hitting he was. Let's listen.
Well, I see so much talent today. I really do. Big, strong guys that swing a bat pretty good, but they don't know that little game as good as they should know it between the pitcher and himself. They don't hit according to the count. They don't hit according to the score. They don't hit according to what they did the last two or three times at the plate. They don't hit according to the wind.
They don't hit according to the wind. He took it all into account, it sounds like.
He did. And he was a student of the game and studied other pitchers very carefully. He would always ask his teammates who had been up before him, what's the guy throwing? What did he throw you? If the guy struck out, he wouldn't be in a mood to really talk to Williams, and often he would just say, I don't know what he struck. I struck out, and I don't know what the pitch was. And Ted would say, what do you mean you don't know? How could you not know? And so he was always getting information wherever he could, including from the umpires. The umpires loved Williams. And
so what would he ask the umpires? What are they throwing out there?
Yeah, he'd get on base after a single or a double, and he'd you know, all the players knew the umpires, and he'd say, where you been? What series have you worked? And how is so-and-so pitching? And what's he have? What's he look? And the umpires liked him, and they gave him information until the league got wind of it and shut it down. But they had immense respect for Williams because he never argued a call. He had this, which was sort of ironic because he had such a temper, but he respected umpires and they respected him. Once there was a catcher who turned around, and the opposition always thought Williams got four strikes. And once a catcher turned around and to mildly argue a call of a ball that he thought should have been a strike, and the umpire turns to the catcher and says, "Mr. Williams will let you know when your pitcher throws a strike."
That's great. He was a real perfectionist, and I'm wondering if you describe this in the book, how he prepared for each game. I mean, he went through almost a sort of ritual, right?
Well, he'd like to strip down to his skivvies and put on some sandals and swing a bat in front of the mirror.
Yeah. In fact, there's a sort of famous picture of him in this pose,
yep,
right?
Yep. And he'd swing the bat and say, "I'm the best blankety blank hitter that ever lived." Swing a bat again. I'm the very profane fellow.
Yeah, so a lot of confidence there. Listeners, we're talking to Ben Bradley Jr. He's the author of The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. You mentioned his temper, and it's been remarked upon many times, and you go into this, that he was a sort of roiling mix of contradictions, of sort of a tortured soul, And one of the big sort of difficult relationships he has is with the Boston sports writers of that time. And you write about this extraordinary season that he has in 1939, his rookie season. And then when he comes back for 1940, this difficult relationship with the Boston press really takes shape. What happens there? Why is it so difficult for him?
Well, he was a perfectionist, and he thought that he worked very hard and was very accomplished, and he didn't take criticism well. Hmm. Very thin-skinned, rabbit ears, could always pick out the one boo in the crowd, and didn't really understand or appreciate the role of the baseball writers. And I was particularly interested in that dynamic because I think it was important to understanding Williams and a window into his character. He always said that he hit better angry, and so he would manufacture these feuds with the press in order to get more motivation, and then he often would go off on a tear and hit 500 for the month. He always felt he got a bad press, but really he didn't. He got mostly a positive press. His one chief antagonist was a fellow called Dave Egan, who was the also who wrote under the pseudonym of the Colonel. He was the columnist for the Daily Record, and he was a contrarian, and Williams owned the town. And so the Colonel decided that it was his job to take him down. And so
he refers to him as what? T. William Esquire.
T. Right? Williams Esquire.
T. Williams Esquire, right. Yeah.
And the other players were kind of marveled at the dynamic between Williams and the writers, and they were scared to be critical of the writers, the other players, because they feared that he'd get a bad press. But one guy, there was one fellow, Don Budden, the old Red Sox shortstop back in the day, and I interviewed him, and he said he once asked Ted, how can you treat the writers so badly? And Williams said, "Son, if you can hit 350, you can do a lot of things."
Well, let me play another piece of tape from Ted Williams. Here he is being asked at a press conference after his Hall of Fame induction in 1966 about this difficult relationship with the writers. Let's listen.
"Did you feel that you were under pressure as a player? Did this in any way influence your attitude toward criticism when you were an active player?"
"No, I think as a matter of fact, if anything, it helped me. Because some of them, at times, some of the things that I read that I didn't feel was just exactly fair, irritated me to a point at times that I think spurred me on a little bit."
And you write that this conflict with the press was largely manufactured by him to fuel his drive to excel. So you think he really needed it?
He needed the conflict. He said he hit better angry. Someone once wrote that he nurtured his rage. Mm. And I think that's true.
Mm. Ben, you suggest that the anger that he so often showed was at least partly explained by a difficult childhood. His father was a drunk, a sort of ne'er-do-well. Tell us about his mother, who you describe as a bit of a zealot, much more committed to issues beyond caring for Ted Williams and his brother.
She worked for the Salvation Army, and that was her entire life and what she seemed to care about the most. She was Mexican, which we could also talk about. I think it's very interesting, a little-known fact that Williams, who looked so Anglo and had a last name of Williams, grew up Mexican-American, which he tried to conceal. But the mother was out until all hours of the night trying to save souls on the streets of Depression-era San Diego. And she would be out until 12 o'clock at night. Mm. And Williams and his younger brother Danny were some of the original latchkey kids. They were home on the porch. The father wasn't around. They'd be waiting for someone to come home. And luckily for Ted, there was a playground down the a few blocks from the house that had floodlights, and so he would play.
And
kept him out of trouble.
Kept him out of trouble, but his early development as a baseball player, it sounds like it happens without the support of his parents or without the active sort of participation and encouragement.
Oh, really? Yeah, he did it all on his own. The mother tried to interest him in the Salvation Army and get him out on the street with the, marching in the band and beating the bass drum. And William said that was one of his most bitter memories, and he felt ashamed and embarrassed. And the father was never a factor at all until Ted signed his first pro contract, and the father turned up and wanted a piece of the action.
Mm. Well, say more about his mother. You mentioned that just a moment ago, that she was Mexican, and Williams hid that, didn't want to be known as Mexican-American. In fact, that really, his ethnic background wasn't even revealed until, a month before he died.
Yeah,
so.
To me, this is one of the most interesting parts of the Williams story. It came out in a month before he died in an article in The Globe by Bill Nowlin. And no one knew about it. No one was, everyone was surprised. His mother was born in Mexico and had family going back there several generations. And they had extended family in Santa Barbara. So there was a whole gaggle of relatives on the mother's side that Ted sort of disparagingly referred to as the Mexicans, and he really didn't want anything to do with them. Hmm. There was one famous story now, or one of my favorite stories, in 1939, after doing so well as a rookie in Boston his first year, he came back to San Diego, the conquering hero. He arrived at the train station, and there was about 100 of the extended Mexican clan waiting for him to greet him. And he took one look at them and hightailed it in the other direction. Didn't want to be seen with them.
Ben Bradley Jr. is the author of The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Let's get a couple of callers into this conversation. Tom is calling from West Roxbury. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. I was bragging to a fellow a resident at the retirement community where I work. We started talking about the Red Sox because I had my old baseball cap on with a big B on it. And I bragged that I had one degree of separation from Ted Williams because my buddy Skip's grandfather used to be Ted Williams' fly fishing guide, and Skip has vivid childhood recollections of Ted Williams bouncing him on his knee. And he says, "I got you beat." He says, "When I was in college, I was 18, I went to get a haircut in Kenmore Square, and there was a guy in the chair with a towel on his face, and people were working on his hands." And he asked the barber, he says, "What's that guy doing?" He says, "He's getting a manicure." He says, "What's a manicure?" And Ted lifted the towel off his face and pointed at the kid and said, "Get that kid a manicure on me."
That's a great story. Thank you, Tom, for that story. I know it reminds me of Tom's story of, this mix of sort of angry, combative, but also generous, and you write about this. He visited kids who were sick with cancer. He supported the Jimmy Fund in a big way, and he didn't want the scribes to write about it and make a big deal of it.
Right, right. Well, that shows that he was genuine.
Yeah.
He was scared that if it was written about, it would look like he was trying to curry favor with the press and try to improve his image, which was often quite bad. He was, you know, Peck's bad boy. But he really cared about kids. He had a good heart. And that was sort of the flip side of his anger, that he was kind.
Mm. Let me ask you about, you know, this really bizarre sort of end of his life, or what happens after he dies, and this strange chapter involving his son, John Henry, who was interested in cryonics, and he decides to have his dad's body frozen after Ted Williams dies. The idea here is that someday when science permits, right, the body could be thawed out, these great people could be brought back to life somehow. Truly bizarre, but tell us something about that. I mean, what was motivating John Henry?
Well, he was a dreamer, sort of a Peter Pan type. Mm. And he was a kid who really didn't accomplish a whole lot on his own, and whose identity was totally subsumed in that of his father. He took over, just after graduating from college, he took over the Ted's memorabilia business. And the last part of the book is really about a father and a son who had been theretofore estranged and hadn't had much to do with each other. It's about how they discovered each other late in life. And I think John Henry certainly exploited his father, but he also loved his father, too.
Well, was this sort of macabre, and we don't have to go into it, and I know you've talked about it, but I mean, for folks that haven't read this part, I mean, this sort of macabre descriptions of what this sort of cryonics episode was about, with the Ted Williams' head being removed from his body and put in cold storage and so on and so forth. John Henry, who we should say died a while back of leukemia, was this part of an effort to exploit his father, do you think, or was there something? No, you don't.
I concluded not, ultimately. I think it was more sort of a Peter Pan-like effort to hold on to his father and to hope that they could be together. You know, cryonics is widely dismissed by most serious scientists as just a hope and a prayer that medical science will one day advance to the point where you'll be able to cure someone from whatever it was that he died from, and somehow bring them back to life. You know, but there are a lot of holes in the theory, and they haven't quite worked out if you would come back as an 83-year-old man or a young stud who could hit 406 again, you know.
Well, let's hear from Ted Williams himself again. He was really obsessed with being sort of the greatest hitter that ever lived, and here he is again with Bob Costas in 1993 talking about how folks have remembered him. Let's listen to this.
I love it when they say he's one of the greatest hitters that ever lived, and when I'm put in the category of Ruth and Gehrig and Simmons and Fox and Hornsby and Aaron and Mays and DiMaggio, that's good enough for me. But I want to tell you something. In the 50s, Look magazine, pretty reputable magazine, wrote one of the biggest articles that even in 1953 or 4 or 5, that I had more game-winning hits than anybody in baseball history. Right then.
So obviously, this was important to him, wasn't it, to be remembered this way?
Oh, sure. He said from day one that his goal was to be remembered as the greatest hitter that ever lived. And for my money, he was.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, you write a lot about his sort of difficult relationship with his wives, cantankerous, combative in a lot of ways. But do you think that when someone is so focused, such a perfectionist this way, that the personal side of one's life, of his life, is almost destined to suffer?
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, there are a lot of people who excel so much at what they do that a lot of china gets broken in the process. Mm. A lot of other facets of his life get shortchanged, and that was true of Williams. He didn't really. He was single-minded. He was determined. He strived for excellence in whatever he undertook. And he wasn't just excellent at baseball. He was excellent in fishing. mm-hmm. in the Fishing Hall of Fame.
He was an accomplished military pilot.
He
too,
was
right?
Not just a, he wasn't just doing a KP duty in World War II in Korea. He was a Marine fighter pilot who saw action in through. He flew 39 missions in Korea and was famously shot down. Should have died, survived and lived to tell the story.
I'm curious, Ben Bradley, what drew you to this? I know you saw Ted Williams at play as a young boy. You met him. You got an autographed baseball. But what drew you to this story?
Well, he was a figure in my life. I grew up around here among the many boys of that age who looked up to him. I was fascinated not just by the fact that he was so such a great hitter, but his persona, and going to Fenway Park back then and watching him play, that was something.
Yeah.
The atmospherics in the park changed. People were on the edge of their seat. Always looking for something that would unusual that would happen.
And see, it's so interesting to hear, and you write about this really well, because for most of his career, the Red Sox didn't do that well. He only appeared in one World Series. But you make the point that even in a lackluster season or in a lackluster game, anytime he came up to bat, it was like the atmosphere just changed, right?
Totally. And this old sports writer told me a story once. He saw a blind man at the game. And he went up to the blind man and said, "Excuse me, sir, why are you here at the park if you can't see? Why aren't you home listening to the game on the radio?" And the guy said, "Because I like the sounds of the park when Ted Williams comes to bat."
Wow, that's a great memory. Finally, 10 years on this project, you did something like 600 interviews. As we've made clear, as you've made clear, Williams was sort of this mass of contradictions. After all this work, what's your sense of the man? I mean, who was he? How do you want to remember him? How do you remember him?
Well, he was an artist. Artist with the bat. A diva. He was a perfectionist who strove for excellence in anything he undertook. As I said earlier, he was a troubled soul. Who struggled with anger, but ultimately, I think it's a redemptive story that he had a kind and decent heart and helped a lot of people along the way and touched a lot of lives.
That's Ben Bradley Jr. He's a journalist and author of The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. You can read an excerpt at radioboston.org. And Ben Bradley, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for this monumental piece of work on Ted Williams.
Thank you.
Really great. Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, slam poetry in the Cantab Lounge basement and Boston's unique history of handbell ensemble. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.